Today we have three former trusted employees to tell us about their firsthand experiences with John Lennon and Yoko. First, we have the author of a new book, which is called The Last Days of John Lennon, which is already making headlines. As you can see, it was in the New York Post last Friday. The new book reveals John and Yoko's dark secrets. Okay, will you please welcome John Lennon's former assistant, Frederick Seaman. Nice to have you. It's causing such a stir. I mean, everybody's talking about it. How long did you, first of all, work with them?
I worked from them from February 79 until the end of 1981. So I worked for John for 2 years, and then I stayed on 1 year with Yoko.
So 3 years total.
Yeah.
And he was killed, what, 11 years ago?
Yes, it was December 8, 1980. Yeah.
Why did you wait so long to write the book?
First of all, I wasn't sure that I wanted to write a book, and it took me a while to decide to do it. Then, once I did write a book, Yoko managed to block me. She's a very powerful woman. She has very high-powered lawyers, and she managed to sabotage two of my book deals over the years.
How sabotage?
She made phone calls, and she threatened litigation, and she is a woman who is known for being highly litigious, so yeah. Her threats were taken very seriously, and most publishers in this country are not known for their courage.
What about... There was a whole thing that you stole John Lennon's diaries. I remember reading that.
I don't feel that I stole the diaries. I did take the diaries out of the Dakota. It was my intention to give them to Julian. Less than 6 months before he died, John told me that if anything happened to him, he wanted me to make sure that Julian got the journals, because he knew that Yoko would not give them to Julian, because Yoko held Julian in great contempt, both Julian and Cynthia. I took them
Cynthia
out
Cynthia is John's
first wife.
First wife,
right.
And Julian, as we all know, is signed
right.
by that marriage. And,
yeah.
and the star, the rock star now, yeah.
Yeah, so I took them out of the Dakota. And
where they live, the Dakotas where they live.
Yes, and I foolishly entrusted them to a friend of mine who promised to copy them overnight so I could return the originals back to the Dakota and take a set of copies to Julian.
Right.
This close friend of mine disappeared with the journals and then subsequently tried to pressure me into writing a book with him. And he eventually sold the journals to a third man, a guy named Norman Schoenfeld, a diamond dealer and a dubious businessman. And Schoenfeld returned them to Yoko for a finder's fee.
But weren't you, you were arrested for the, I mean...
I wasn't arrested. I was assaulted by two of Yoko's bodyguards who also happened to be New York City cops.
But weren't you on probation?
I was. I did plead guilty to...
So you had to be arrested and plead, yeah.
Yes, and I did plead guilty to one count of larceny in connection with the journals because I admitted taking them, yeah. and I was sentenced to 5 years probation in 1983.
When that happened, and Yoko got the journals back, why isn't she going to release them? What are the terrible things that are in there about her?
Well, the journals paint a very different picture of their relationship than the kind of myth that Yoko still to this day spreads in the media.
Well, we all hear that it was the most beautiful, wonderful, idyllic relationship.
The Romeo and Juliet of the 60s.
Give me a kiss and let's write a song. Yeah.
yeah.
That's a, well, he had to love her to listen to that voice day in and day out.
He did love her.
I mean, that has to be love. Yeah. What was it? Was it tempestuous or what?
It wasn't very tempestuous because John was, at the time that I got there, he was basically denatured. He wasn't allowing himself to express much emotion. He got angry a lot of times, but then Yoko would just avoid him. So he'd go off and sulk in the bedroom and Yoko would be in her office and she'd start making phone calls and whatnot. So he didn't have much of a relationship. He really couldn't express himself much.
Was it a business relationship? I know she ruled... Or took care of all the business.
She controlled everything, all aspects of John's life, his money, his social interactions, everything.
And he allowed it?
Yes.
Was it always that way or just...
It was that way when I got there in 1979, and it was that way when he went back with Yoko in 1975 after he broke up with May.
Right.
That's when he pretty much regressed to a childlike state, and he decided to let Yoko run his life. He turned over his life, lock, stock, and barrel to Yoko.
Would the drugs have anything to do with this?
I don't think so, because in 1979, he wasn't doing any hard drugs. The only drug that John Lennon was really addicted to while I was there was nicotine. He was a chain smoker. He smoked, like, very strong Gitan cigarettes. So I don't think I don't think that drugs played a role in that.
What about her? I mean... There were no drugs in the household?
Oh, there were drugs. I mean, he smoked pot. Yeah, he smoked pot.
But you were carrying bags of drugs for them at one point.
Well,
I would call that drugs. I mean,
I did pick up.
I just remembered. I did pick up.
I some tie sticks for John on occasion.
But isn't it in your book that you say she's in heroin?
I read the book last night. Yeah, she has. She's been using heroin for a long time, since the late 1960s, and she's admitted it in public. She said things like she took it as a celebration, and because she and John were in so much pain when they first got together, because the British media was really beating up on her, so that's when she, and John got into heroin.
But he was off of it.
John got off, you see, and he stayed off. Certainly, I never really saw him do heroin. Yoko never really got off. She, from time to time, made an effort. She would announce to the staff that she was going to go on a cleansing fast, right, which was sort of her way of saying that she was going to try to withdraw. But to my knowledge, she never really managed, because she didn't have the discipline to really withdraw.
Did she go on the cleansing fast? I know there was a 10-day of silence.
10-day silence, yeah.
Did they both do that together?
No, well, John did the silence. What happened was that Yoko sent John and me and Sean and my Aunt Helen, who was Sean's nanny, out to their house in Cold Spring Harbor. And then she showed up one weekend and announced that John was going to go on a 10-day silent vow. He was not allowed to speak for 10 days. He was not allowed to drink coffee. He was not allowed to read newspapers, watch television. No, he was allowed to watch television with the sound off. So she imposed all these restrictions on him, and then she disappeared back to the Dakota. And I found out that in the Dakota, she sort of barricaded herself in her bedroom with her boyfriend at the time, a man named Sam Green.
She had boyfriends?
She had a boyfriend, yes, at that time, a man that she was romantically infatuated with.
Did John know about this?
I don't think he fully realized at that time, in the spring of 1980, the full extent of Yoko's infatuation with Sam Green.
He was the only man, or there were other men that you...
After Sam Green, she became involved with a man named Sam Havatoy, who is with her to this day, as far as I know. He moved into the Dakota after John's death, and he became her constant companion and business manager.
So while they were alive, was he having affairs too?
John, no. He didn't allow himself that luxury. He was terrified of his marriage breaking up, and he was just too scared. He did, at the end of his 10-day silent vow, he was allowed a trip to Cape Town, South Africa, where he told me he cavorted with hookers for a couple of days in a hotel room.
Are people in shock at all these things starting to come out? I want to find out about that. I want to find out their relationship with Sean.
Yes.
There's so many things. And she ate, after the baby, she tried to eat the placenta?
Well, what happened?
Wait, let's go.
Oh, okay.
Let's go to commercial. Am I correct when
yes,
I say
you
she
are
tried
correct.
To eat the placenta?
It was her intention to eat the placenta.
I'm nauseous. We'll be back in a moment. We are back talking with Frederick Seaman, author of The Last Days of John Lennon. We started to talk about Sean's birth. Sean was born on the same day, so they had the same birth as his father.
Right.
Now, was that a lucky coincidence?
Well, when I first found out about it, I asked John. I told him, this is an amazing coincidence that you guys are both on the same birthday. And he just looked at me and said, it wasn't an accident. There are no accidents. And later I found out that what happened was that Yoko had attempted to have babies on John's birthday several times, and she'd suffered miscarriages on October 9th, John's birthday, and that Sean was born by cesarean section on October 9th, several weeks premature.
So she went a doctor allowed that to walk
well,
in down with the baby?
I don't think she announced to the doctor that she was going to have this premature cesarean. She just went into the hospital. Actually, she was in the hospital on the 8th, and as soon as midnight rolled around, she said, oh, I'm in terrible pain, you know, it's coming or whatever. She convinced the doctors to do the cesarean. The doctors didn't know what was going on. And when Sean was born, he was trembling and he was shaking. So the doctors did a spinal tap on him because they thought maybe there was something wrong with him. And when it turned out there was nothing wrong with Sean neurologically, they decided that he must be born addicted, that he was having a tremors from addiction. And in fact, John later hinted that Yoko may have done heroin during the pregnancy.
And that was...
Because John wasn't doing any, so it couldn't have come from him.
It had to come
and
from...
the doctors at first didn't want to release Sean. They threatened to either keep him or get an injunction against him. So John and Yoko fled the hospital, you know, in a panic with the baby, and it was a real nightmare.
What about her eating the placenta? Well, I mean, I've heard of weird things.
Yoko,
it's like, you know,
one of Yoko's
Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah. One of Yoko's obsessions... Yoko was obsessed with staying young because she was 8 years older than John, and she was always on the lookout for miracle cures that would rejuvenate her. She had heard that in some cultures, women eat the placenta because it's supposed to have a rejuvenating effect on them, and she decided that she would give it a shot. So she saved the placenta from Sean's birth, apparently, and she instructed someone to freeze it in the refrigerator. And unfortunately...
would you like shrimp or a placenta? Some good friends over. You bring the wine, I'll bring the placenta.
Anyway, I think the maid accidentally left the refrigerator door open, so the placenta spoiled, and Yoko never did get to try it out. So.
She should have marinated it. That's, what about... That was some household. What about the other relationship with the Beatles? Because, you know, you wonder, were they close?
No,
she close to them? Was
Yoko wasn't close with the Beatles because she hated them, and they accommodated her because she had John, so they had to deal with her if they wanted to have any contact with John. While I was there, the only Beatle who had any contact, direct contact with John, from what I could tell, was Ringo. He came to the Dakota once in the winter of 1979, I believe, and John spent some time with him in the kitchen, and, you know, he played with Sean. The other Beatles, he didn't get along with too well. Paul, John was jealous of, because Paul was still active as a musician. He was still cranking out hits. George, he wasn't too close with, because there had been a big fight after the benefit concert in 1971, where George had invited John, but not Yoko. And that caused a big fight between John and Yoko, and then it caused a big rift between George and John, and they really didn't have much contact.
What about the allegations in the book that the drug bust with Paul McCartney was due to Yoko?
Yeah. Paul stopped by New York on his way to Japan in January of 1980. He had a sold-out tour with Wings planned. He called the Dakota. He wanted to come over and get stoned with John, like in the old days. Right up to 1978, I think he used to stop by from time to time in the Dakota and spend some time with John. Yoko, of course, wouldn't put Paul through to John, but she did speak to him. She learned during the course of their conversation that, he or Linda had scored, his wife, Linda Eastman, had scored some marijuana, and B, that Paul and Linda planned to stay at the presidential suite of the Hotel Okura, which was John and Yoko's favorite suite. That's where they always stayed when they went to Japan. When Yoko heard this, she hit the ceiling. She told John that under no circumstances could they allow Paul to move into their hotel room at the Okura, because it would forever spoil their hotel karma. So she told John, and John, of course...
She ought to meet Leona Helms.
Yeah.
And
John, of course, immediately, like, parroted her line. And when I ran into him in the kitchen, he told me, can you believe the nerve of Paul and Linda? They actually want to move into our hotel room. And he said, but Yoko is going to make sure it doesn't happen. Yoko promised me she was going to put a spell on Paul, and he's never going to move into that hotel room. Next thing we knew, Paul was busted at Tokyo Airport, and Yoko had met all afternoon with one of her psychics in her office, and she told John she was working on the Paul and Japan problem. Meanwhile, a lot of phone calls were made, and we later heard that she had a cousin or a distant relative who was working at the airport. So she just made a phone call, and the Japanese knew that Paul was carrying pot. They didn't want to bust him, apparently. They wanted to avoid it. They asked him three times to turn over whatever he had. Paul, for whatever reason, just became very arrogant and huffy, and so they searched his bags. The drugs were apparently readily findable, and they took him off to jail for 10 days. And what really what killed John was the fact that we heard that Paul was being forced by his Japanese jailers to play Yesterday over and over on a guitar. Paul loved it, you know.
I want to talk more with you and about the occult, because you just went into that very little, the whole occult that was in the marriage the whole time, her meetings with people. We will be back. We're going to be joined, if you will please stay with us, joined by John Lennon's ex-lover, May Pang.
She worked with John Lennon and Yoko Ono, and within a short time after being hired, she became John's mistress. And she also arranged, who arranged this explosive affair? Yoko Ono set it up. Yoko set it up, John's wife. So if anybody's got stories, she does. Please welcome May Pang. Yoko?
Yoko.
I thought I was leaving the prompt room. Yoko set up?
Yeah. She came into my office one morning and said, May, you know John and I are not getting along. And I said, I'm sorry to hear that. And she goes, well, listen, if he's going to start seeing people, I want you to go out with him. I said, me? I said, I don't want your husband. She goes, no, no. I know you'll be nice. I know he likes you. You'll go out with him. I said, no. And she said, yes, you will. And she got up and walked out of the room.
And so you went out with him?
No, not quite. I freaked out, of course. And she went in, and I heard from John that she went in and said to John, I fixed it. And as he was shaving, he goes, fixed what, Yoko? And goes, I fixed it so you can go out with May. He almost slit his throat. And afterwards, we both sort of like went into our separate rooms, and she just wanted this to go on.
And finally you did become his mistress?
Finally, and it was after John decided, you know, if she's going to let me do this and go out and have affairs, and I'm going to go for it.
And you were together, what, 18 months?
18 months.
Now, did it become a love affair, or was it kind of like, well, okay, convenience?
No, it was a love affair. We actually moved in together. We were together all the time, 24 hours a day.
So was she upset? I mean, it's one thing to say to your husband, all right, dally, it's not all right, but, you know, dally a little, I'll pick the woman. It's another thing to say, he says, goodbye, and I'm moving in with her.
Absolutely. She did not realize it was going to turn into such a big love affair. She thought it would be 2 weeks, gone, and goodbye. And it didn't turn out that way. And she didn't know what to do, so she let it go on. And she would come out to visit us.
Where were you living?
By this point, we went out to Los Angeles. And she came out to see how the thing was going, how our affair was going. She goes, I'm glad everything's going on all right. Then she left and went back to New York. And then by this point, she started having an infatuation with another person.
So all through the marriage, they were not, you know, we saw all these, they're in bed together, they're starving for peace together, they're making records together. All through the marriage, they were actually...
Well, I think early on in their relationship, there was a very hot sexual interaction, which is documented in John's erotic lithographs.
Yeah.
But obviously, by the time Yoko told May to get involved with John, the flame had gone out of the marriage, and it wasn't happening
so
anymore.
Why didn't the marriage break up? Why, or was it breaking up?
It was breaking up, and she even asked for a divorce, and she didn't expect the answer to come from John to say, okay, fine, let's do it. And it was only a month or two later that she realized that he meant it, that she said, oh no, the stars aren't right, let's get
divorced. And also her lawyers told her that she couldn't keep much of the money if she divorced John.
So she backed out?
Oh yeah, she wasn't getting anywhere without John's name.
Did he think, and then I'm going to go to the occult, because we keep coming back, they always say the stars weren't right, wasn't right. Did he think she had talent?
I think in public, he would make pronouncements like Yoko was ahead of her time and she's an avant-garde genius. But in private, he knew that certainly she had no musical talent. I mean, he wasn't a highly skilled musician himself. He had a great natural talent, but he knew that Yoko had no voice and really couldn't write a song.
Now, what about the occult? She was into the stars and psychics, and someone told me tarot cards.
Yes. Directionalist, numerologist, you name it.
Everything. I mean, at one point she even had a tarot reader accuse me of stealing jewels from her.
Stealing jewels?
Yeah. And I mean, he said that he had sent these jewels to me to send to her. And of course, it never got to her. So when she called him up, the tarot reader said, oh no, I sent them to May. She obviously took them.
Now, was she into accusing people of stealing? That's two people sitting here now. Both of them had an experience.
That happened quite frequently. While I was there, a maid was once accused of stealing a camel hair coat, and the maid was fired. The coat was later found in the Dakota, misplaced. They had a caretaker couple in Palm Beach. Yoko accused them of stealing a fur coat. It even made headlines in the Palm Beach newspapers. The couple was fired. Later, the fur coat turned up in storage.
So she's just always worried someone's going to take.
Right. I had a girlfriend that had the same experience. She borrowed one of John's fur coats and wanted, John wanted it back, and she brought it back. But Yoko said, oh, I haven't seen it.
And so again, stealing.
Right.
Have you seen Yoko since this?
Yes, I did.
Terrible tragedy.
Yes, I saw her in '88 at a function, but she claimed she never saw me. But we were like less than 2 feet from one another. And then at the time, my husband and I left the function to go have a nice meal somewhere else. And rumor had it afterwards that it was told that we were asked to leave because it was causing conflict with her. We had no idea that was going on.
That's so will you stay? We're going to bring out yet a third person. Right. When we come back, we're going to be joined by a man who worked for John and Yoko for 5.5 years.
I might try and talk to him as I was running. Oh, peace, brother, peace. You know, but I'd believe in run away and live to fight another day.
Talking about the last days of John Lennon, and my next guest worked with John and Yoko for 5.5 years, first as their gardener, then later on as their archivist. In doing so, he weeded out not only dandelions and poison ivy, but also hundreds of hours of Lennon footage and soundtracks. Please welcome Michael Tree Medeiros. It's nice to have you all. Archivist, what did you do? Just go around the house and find tapes and pictures and categorize them and catalog them and what?
When it started out, I was just keeping track of all their hundreds of tapes and records and videos. And later on, after John died, then I began to organize everything, all the appearances they had made on film, on video, things they had written together, their performance art.
The things in the book that we have now by Fred, are they true? And we just read, like, the psychics. Were they so involved with psychics?
I read Fred's book, and I see it as essentially true.
Did you come across any tapes or anything?
Oh, they used every kind of psychic you could think of. Tarot card readers, astrologers. I happened to meet a man by the name of Charlie Swan or John Green, who was their tarot card reader. I didn't know it at the time, and he sent me to the Dakota to advise a friend of his about plants. And I found out later that this man had done some astrology reading and tarot card reading, and I was the right person. So they used all of this.
So they used it before they hired people.
See, everybody who worked there had to be astrologically screened. In my case, it was easy because my birthday was October 10th, the day after John. That was a perfect qualification.
And apparently this man told me that my birthday was one of the tarot cards, the 14th in Venus. John once said to me that, the oracle has said that you are ceremonially placed around Yoko.
Okay. What about John watching television all day? They said he loved to sit and watch television. He loved to gossip, that he loved any kind of a gossip. He would have loved the show.
He loved that.
He was a media junkie.
Absolutely. Yeah. He loved gossip. He constantly said, oh, did you know this? Oh, God, I didn't know that. And he watched his night show. He loved that. I mean, he was a real media freak. He'd sit in front of the TV. He would have the music blaring, but the TV was on at all times with the sound off. But it was always on.
Always on. Yeah. What about the relationship with Sean? Remember they said he left being actively in the business for a while to become a house husband, a house father. Was that so? Was he?
It was very much so. I started there, I guess Sean might have been 6 or 7 months old. And he took care of Sean a great deal. He saw, he prepared food or he made sure what food Sean was going to get. He would play the guitar when he was going to sleep at night. He would read him stories. From books. He was with him a great deal.
Give me a typical day at the Dakota where they live.
Well, John would generally get up very early and then he'd go to the kitchen, read the daily news, have a coffee, eat some shredded wheat. And then when Sean showed up, he'd go back to the bedroom and pretty much stay in the bedroom until it was time for lunch. Then he'd come out to have lunch. And meanwhile, Yoko was downstairs all the time, so they didn't have much contact.
Yoko took care of all the business.
Absolutely. Well, in that sense, yeah. When during my time before these gentlemen were there, I mean, Yoko was up at crack of dawn going through the mail, sifting through it, and going back to the bedroom, and then John would come out later with Yoko at about 11 o'clock in the morning.
But she really, which is great.
Yeah, she didn't run the business at the time, but she would tell you exactly what she wanted.
Right.
And in 1978, she had an office built downstairs by this guy, Sam Havitoy, who eventually became her live-in companion. And once she had the office downstairs, she spent more and more time there because she had a Napoleonic camp bed that she would sort of take naps on. She didn't need much sleep.
Yes, that's true.
When we come back, I want to talk about their relationship with Julian, if he got pushed aside when Sean was born, and also, of course, the last days and the night of the murder and what took place in the apartment right after that Joan was shot.
I couldn't believe it, really, because, as we all know, he was such a nice person, really. I mean, he was stubborn, and there were certain things about him which maybe people would have wanted to change in him, but, you know, he was such a great person that it seemed ridiculous, you know? I mean, in some ways it's understandable if somebody goes to try and assassinate Adolf Hitler or something, but John Lennon had just, you know, given all that love and great songs.
We're back talking about the last days of John Lennon. Just one question before we get into that horrible last day. Julian and Sean, was Julian pushed out of the way? You said that Yoko considered him a second-class citizen.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. She didn't get along with Julian. In fact, I was the one who tried to get him as close to, you know, father and son. Mm-hmm. And I told John, I said, it's important for you to be part of that in his life. And he said, you're right.
Did Julian get half the estate?
Well, that's an interesting question. The will, I believe, was probated at $30 million, and half of that went to Yoko outright, I believe, and the other half was supposed to be distributed by her to his British relatives and other relatives. But in fact, there is a lot of indication that Yoko kept pretty much all of it. And there were a few trust funds. There was a trust fund for Julian, there's a trust fund for Sean. But I don't think Cynthia or Aunt Mimi got very much of that money.
What about the last day? Why wasn't there high security? I mean, I have very high security. I mean, I'm nobody, you know?
Their local security man, Doug McDougall, was always pressing Yoko to have people, especially once they started recording, to have people in the limousine going in and out of the Dakota and the Hit Factory. She just said John wouldn't feel comfortable with these people hovering around, and she said no.
In fact, what happened was that Yoko gave an interview to Daily News in late September of 1980 when they were recording the album, and she described in detail their recording hours, what time they went to the studio, even what route they took. And when Doug, the bodyguard, read this interview, he hit the ceiling. He went to her, he said, Yoko, you know, you're asking every wacko in the country to come after you and John. You know, you have to do increased security. And he suggested having a guard posted at each end at the recording studio at the Dakota, or having a guard ride with them in the limo. Yoko, you know, shot down every suggestion. And finally, Doug, the bodyguard, just threw his hands up in the air and said, well, Yoko, you know, if you want to get yourself and John killed, that's your business. I just don't want to be known as the bodyguard who failed to protect John Lennon.
Did he have a premonition? You said in the book that...
I think so, yeah.
I think he did, too. John was always a very impatient man. He was very quick. And it seemed like the last month or so, he was just unflappable. You know, he had given me a job to do. I didn't get it done, and I was expecting the sky to fall. And he said, oh, it's okay, it's okay. And he just seemed to relax. And
he wrote that song, Living on Borrowed Time. Yeah. That's not just a song. I think that is a kind of a statement of premonition.
Did she grieve? Was she devastated?
I don't know. I tried calling, and she wouldn't answer my phone calls.
That's
true. But he wouldn't answer. He really didn't want to talk to Cynthia. She didn't want to talk to many people that I know of.
She did grieve. Of course she did. I think Yoko did nothing but smoke cigarettes for almost a week, and then she started eating chocolates and smoking cigarettes.
What about where is he now? He's buried, or he's been cremated?
He's been cremated, and I think he would have wanted
wish?
That.
I don't think so. He told me once that given a choice, he'd like to be buried at sea, or, you know, buried, but not. He had a horror of cremation, I think.
You spoke to the murderer right after. How did that happen?
Yeah, I was leaving the Dakota, and some fans who knew I worked for John came up to me and said hello, and this man, Chapman, came up to the fans, and they pointed me out saying that I worked for him, and he introduced himself. Hi, I'm Mark David Chapman. I've come all the way from Hawaii to see John. Meanwhile, I'm thinking, this is very strange. This man is from Hawaii. He looked like milk. And he was speaking in the southern accent, but there was no premonition that this man had any bad intentions.
We have to wind up, unfortunately, because it's been a fascinating, fascinating time. Are you all frightened of Yoko? You mentioned
she once sent two bodyguards after me who beat me and put a gun to my head and threatened to blow my brains out.
Yeah.
And I later found out that these guys were actually New York City cops, and one of them is a sergeant assigned to the 112th Precinct in Queens.
You're a little frightened. No, I'm sorry, I just cut off. But I mean, they said you're worried because you have a guitar of John's that she's going to say
No,
that
you took.
John gave me a gift of a banjo that he had.
And you
had.
Just want to go on record saying that he gave it to you as a gift?
Yes.
I just thought we should clarify that.
Okay. I have none. I have none. I'm not frightened of you.
I'm not frightened of you. I even bought her albums retail, so the hell with that. Right? I thank you all very, very much for being fascinating. The book is called The Last Days of John Lennon. And the photographs that you've seen behind me all during the show are from the world-renowned photographer Alan Tannenbaum, and they are loaned to us courtesy of the Williams Gallery. Their telephone number is 609-921-1142. Okay, 609-921-1142. Guys, we'll be back in a moment with gossip on Donna, Ivana, and Mark.